As we know, the Fukushima earthquake and tsunami that ensued killed on the order of 30,000 people and displaced many tens of thousands of others. Many of those displaced were forced to move because of dangerous levels of radiation to which they were exposed. And obviously, there are also health costs, both present and future, that are incurred as a result of the exposure. And this raises really a host of disturbing questions. Who's at fault? How might this nuclear disaster have been avoided, if at all? And once it happens, what should we do about it? Should we let the losses fall where they may on the victims? In other words, leave the victims to civil recourse, which is to say tort law, or establish a compensation fund for the victims? And just to give you a little preview, in Japan, sort of all of those things are possible. And I'm going to be talking about the Japanese system and how it works. But first, I want to do some work on what goes on here in the U.S., sort of the comparative focus. If we do establish a compensation system, how is it funded? Is it funded by the government, which is another way of saying by the taxpayer, right? Or is it funded by the company that caused the problem? So I want to think about compensation. I want to think about tort as one form of compensation. Think about administrative compensation systems, and then think about regulation, which is a way of preventing these problems from arising in the first place. Anyway, answering these questions isn't easy, and it's especially hazardous to do so by looking at how we handle things in the U.S., because our approach here is very inconsistent and, I would argue, problematic. But I want to look at a few domestic disasters and how we've handled them, and maybe see if we can establish a few principles against which to assess the Japanese model, which it seems to me is likelier to lead to good public health outcomes than how we do it here. Okay. Or I could just do this.
Yep.
Okay, so this is my presenter disclosure slide, which must be here for the record, and I'll just move on. Okay, so 9/11 is the first thing I want to look at, as most of you probably know, in the wake of 9/11, Congress created the Victim Compensation Fund, which I think is one of the most interesting sort of exercises of public largesse that I've seen. It ended up spending about $7 billion in taxpayer money, mostly to pay families of those killed on that day, right? Because with 9/11, basically either you got out or you didn't. There were very few in the category of people that were injured but survived. I happen to know one of them personally who was very seriously burned, and I've had several conversations with him about the Victim Compensation Fund, which he was a substantial beneficiary. In this case, individual payments ran as high as $8.6 million, okay? So keep this in mind, $8.6 million of taxpayer money, right? And then late last year, Congress authorized another $4-plus billion to compensate basically first responders, right? But not only first responders. Anybody who was in the area and suffered these long-term respiratory problems is an intended beneficiary under this new fund, which has a different administrator, and has different criteria of eligibility, or I should say expanded criteria. As you might know, there's been a lot of controversy about whether cancer should be covered, right? So far they're not, because there's no clear epidemiological evidence of causation, although I suspect that will change. What you might not know is that the fund doesn't cover PTSD, either for reasons that might be justifiable on some level, which is limited funds and difficulty of diagnosis, but it's hard to justify on other grounds. After all, I think it furthers the perception that mental illnesses are less serious than physical ones, and it doesn't treat cases fairly across the spectrum. But that point about treating cases fairly across the spectrum raises a deeper issue, and that is, why should the victims of 9/11 have been compensated at such a lavish rate? Okay. The model used here for compensation was really a tort model of full compensation. And the government, which admits, the government in this case not admitting fault and not being found liable for harm is doing the paying, which effectively means that all of us are. Okay. This has rarely been done before and for good reason. So let me back up here and provide a minute of tort theory, okay? Because after all, if the government is paying as if it's a tort defendant, then we should be able to justify this on tort principles of compensation. So there are two kinds of justice. There are probably more, but this is the sort of classic Aristotelian distinction between, you know, distributive justice and corrective justice. So when we think of tort law, we usually think of corrective justice, which is, you know, the classic binary cases: somebody hits somebody else with a car, the plaintiff, let's say, is an innocent victim, the defendant has to pay, and it doesn't matter that the defendant might be poor and the plaintiff rich, right? So if a person driving a jalopy hits, Bill Gates, right? The jalopy driver still has to pay Bill Gates, okay? Because we don't look at the holdings of the people, we don't look at their circumstances in the society. We basically say you have an action in civil recourse in tort against the person who injured you to reset the balance that the negligence or worse of the defendant created. When we talk about, though, things like 9/11, which I see as sort of a social risk, okay, right, the risk of terrorism, then it's really hard to justify a corrective justice model, okay? So when government is paying as if it's a tort defendant, that money is coming from everybody else, all right? So if you think about it from that perspective, it's really hard to make sense out of, okay? So somebody who is a worker who is making, you know, $30,000, $40,000 a year, right, some of their tax money was going into compensating the person who was compensated at $8.6 million a year. And very few other sources of payment counted against compensation. It was a little different than tort law in that if you had a life insurance policy, the proceeds of that policy did count against your recovery. So it wasn't completely like tort law, but mostly it was. No matter how much you got from charity, that didn't count against it, for example. Okay, so really tough to justify, and I've written a couple of articles on this, and my thinking or my theory is that it was such an unexpected event. Congress sort of didn't know what to do, and thought by, you know, really sort of putting sandbags of money at the border almost, we could do something about this. It's also a little complicated, too, because they were trying to get people not to sue the airlines for security problems, and so they thought they'd pay them off in that way. But in one of my longer articles, I criticized that attempt at a quid pro quo. Okay, so this should raise for us bigger questions or broader questions of fairness. So you might see this as concentric circles. So at the center of the circle, you might see disaster, and you might look at things like Katrina, or you might look at 9/11 or Fukushima or any other disaster and say that that's sort of the core of it, all right? And you might say, are we treating all people the same within that circle? And then if you start looking at it from a, you know, distributive point of view, you might ask a bigger question, which is about misfortune, right? And you might say, well, why is it that people are compensated for disasters but don't have health insurance, for example? Why should they be left on their own when it comes to other kinds of misfortune? And that just brings us out to these larger questions of fairness. And one of the things that I've talked about is how, sometimes these questions are too big, so we sort of deal with the small issue that's in front of us, whether it's Katrina or whether it's 9/11 or whether it's the BP oil spill. Okay, so let's compare disasters, all right, and I want to look at a few. September 11th / Oklahoma City, which were both terrorist attacks, obviously. Katrina, the BP oil spill, and Fukushima. And then I want to draw some comparisons and differences between the BP oil spill and Fukushima. All right. So let's go back here. With respect to Oklahoma City, for the most part, the victims of the Oklahoma City bombing had to make do with charitable contributions. And that bombing took place years before 9/11. And after 9/11, they went back to Congress and they said, where's our compensation fund? After all, we had the same problems, just on a smaller scale. It won't cost you that much to create a compensation fund for us. And Congress said no. And not even John Stewart had anything to say about it, right? So you might recall when they were talking about passing the first responders bill and it wasn't happening. He had firefighters and police officers on, made a very sympathetic case. but it just for some reason didn't capture the national imagination in the same way that 9/11 did. So which model is better, the 9/11 model, which is lavish compensation? I realize there can be something that sort of sounds insensitive about calling the compensation lavish when it's a horrible tragedy that we're talking about, but compared to how we compensate other things, I'm using that adjective, or Oklahoma City, which is none. So let's look at another disaster, Katrina, which is pictured here on the slide. As is by now well known, I think, that disaster was largely man-made. As it hit New Orleans, the hurricane was only a Category 1 storm. Right, but a combination of poor construction and maintenance by the Army Corps of Engineers and a series of bad decisions by local, state, and federal government meant that substantial parts of the city were flooded. Some were killed and many thousands were rendered homeless and had their businesses and lives forever displaced and destroyed. So what did we do for these people? Well, something, right? Since New Orleans was declared, since the state was declared, you know, disaster area, FEMA money became available to compensate victims. But FEMA compensation, by design, is quite limited. At the time of Katrina, it was capped at around $15,000 per family. All right, that's not much. And the idea of this kind of compensation for disasters is it gives you enough money to sort of get back on your feet to survive. It's not meant to put you in the position you occupied before the disaster took place. It's not based on a tort model at all. And the reason is that it really does take account of these broader, you know, sort of issues that I identified in the earlier slide in terms of overall societal fairness. And by the way, when it comes to FEMA, we do count other funds against people. So if they have insurance policies, if they receive charity, if they have other income, that also reduces the amount that they can receive. But wait, you say, if government is responsible, why not make it pay? I mean, after all, I just identified the Army Corps of Engineers as principal culprits in causing Katrina. If anything, they've got a stronger case for compensation than the victims of 9/11. But it's not that easy, right? Because even though we might say that, in a sense, government here is acting like any other private citizen, instead of the Army Corps of Engineers, it might have been a private engineering company, right, committing this negligence, there's no way of sort of separating taxpayer money from what would go to plaintiffs. Okay, so there's an argument for restricting the payment or the payout to FEMA, FEMA-level payouts. But that doesn't seem right somehow, especially when we think of it in relation to 9/11. So what I proposed in an article was to get creative. Instead of the tort open-ended model of compensation that guesses at future losses, I mean, so tort, you've got a case, and the case is over, right? And we sort of guess what the future losses will be, what will be your lost income, you know, your pain and suffering over a period of time. My suggestion was to have a sort of a long-term administrative compensation system that would hear from people about what they need over a period of however long it took for all of those consequences of Katrina to work themselves out. Things like retraining, rebuilding, community development, and so on. The advantage of that is that you tie compensation to actual loss, right, unlike tort law, which necessarily has to guess. And you are compromising between the need to compensate victims and the fact that the government, when it's compensating, has to look at the overall distributions in the society and not just pay people money. So I guess my bottom line is 9/11, way too much compensation, unjustified by any theory that I've ever heard of or have come up with. Katrina, undercompensation, especially because government was responsible. And part of what's going on in Katrina, right, is that the government doesn't have much to fear from lawsuits because of sovereign immunity, okay? And there's particular sovereign immunity in the context of flood prevention programs. There's a specific statute that applies there. So if you can get the government on a tort claim, or if there's the possibility that they'll be sued, you might get them to come up with a more generous administrative compensation system. And as I looked at Fukushima, which I promise I'll get to one day, it turns out that if you don't have sovereign immunity, it really does create an incentive for government to do the right thing. And there is no sovereign immunity in Japan, so I want to talk about that toward the end of the presentation. What about the BP oil spill? Okay. There's that picture which we saw on our TV for months, right? It just seemed like it was never going to end, right? So those of us who were environmentalists in any way, it was like it was really difficult to watch. So one way of asking this is, you know, obviously it's the fault of BP and other corporate actors, right? I don't know if you read in the paper or heard in the last couple of weeks, I guess Anadarko Petroleum Company, which had a 25% stake in the venture, agreed a few weeks ago to pay BP $4 billion in settlement, and that money is going into the $20 billion compensation fund, which BP has established to compensate the victims. And then, of course, there's Transocean, and then the comically evil Halliburton. Whenever you want sort of a movie villain, you just bring Halliburton in because they were involved in construction of the cement wall or something. Let's look at this. You might say, well, of course it's the fault of BP, right? They didn't. Their blowout preventer was crappy, and their employees didn't do what they were supposed to do. That's true, but there's also a story here of a regulatory agency. In this case, the heretofore unknown and obscure Minerals Management Service, which I bet very few people had even heard of, that was operating with A, an inadequate statute, B, inadequate staffing, and some would argue an agency too much captured by the very industry it was trying to regulate. It thereby allowed unsafe rigs to proliferate, and we have a sad and troubling story, and one that we shouldn't ignore. And if you're interested in getting some of the sobering details, I recommend a report by the Center for Progressive Reform that really goes into all of the sort of systemic problems that allowed the BP oil spill to take place. Now, here's an interesting case, right? Because although governmental immunity, the intricacies of which I won't get into today, because it's actually a very complicated area of the law, might make a suit against the federal government difficult or impossible, there's a sort of justice in the government's getting involved, at least to the extent of pressuring BP into creating a compensation fund, right? So Obama really didn't have a lot to work with, okay? Because the statute... I should say there is a statute that caps liability in these cases. There are fines that are available to the government, but the government didn't waive any of those fines in forcing or in pressuring BP to create the fund. And I think BP just felt like they really had no choice but to do this. And by the way, the BP Compensation Fund is being administered by Ken Feinberg, who was the same guy who administered the first 9/11 fund. So he is Mr. Compensation Fund. He did the Agent Orange Fund years ago, and that's sort of what he does with his time. Most of the loss in the BP case, interestingly, is economic loss, right? You don't have people who are killed by the oil spill. You don't even have a lot of property damage, okay? Mostly what you have is economic loss. Because most of the harm that was suffered to the commons, which is to say the water and the land, right, public lands. And so there are people that had property damage, but most of it is economic loss. And the compensation fund is allowing compensation for economic loss in a much broader way than tort law would ever allow. Tort law is very stingy and restrictive when it comes to economic loss. As you can see in the slide, I'm oversimplifying it, but generally tort law compensates for personal injury, property damage, and economic loss only in cases where you also have personal injury or property damage. To be sure, people like fishermen can recover. If they commonly fish in an area, they're considered to have sort of a quasi-property right in the fish, right? But people like in the Florida Panhandle who are recovering because people stopped coming to their hotels, even though there was no oil there, right? Some of those people have recovered if they can show that they didn't have the business that they had the year before. That would never happen under tort law. It just wouldn't, all right? It's not a compensable category because it's considered to be too speculative. You should have insurance against those things, et cetera, et cetera. We have a case here where the government gets involved to the extent of pressuring a private entity to do something, and they're really paying people in a way that's even more generous than they would have to under tort law. Okay, so what does this all mean? And then I want to talk for a minute about Fukushima. What we want is regulation and oversight before these things happen, ex ante, as the law and economists like to say. It could have prevented Katrina, right? Not the hurricane, but the consequences, okay? As I said, it was a Category 1, and certainly could have prevented BP, all right? So regulation and oversight, and compensation when necessary, all right? So the two ways of compensating, now I'll sort of transition, are administrative systems and tort law, okay? And usually in the U.S., in spite of this little flurry of compensation systems we've had for BP and for 9/11, we usually don't do compensation funds here in the U.S. We can't even get a compensation fund for asbestos, which is the best sort of case in which you should have a compensation fund, because the tort system is actually paying the wrong people for the most part, okay? The people who have the most serious injuries are not always the ones getting compensated, all right? So, but it's really hard to get compensation systems off the ground. Who's going to fund them? Who's in and who's out? What kind of injuries do you have to show? All of these issues raise themselves pretty starkly when it comes to creating compensation funds. And also, since our Congress isn't capable of doing anything, I forgot to mention, is part of the problem. So we have all these, you know, all these great ideas for compensation funds, and they don't happen. And so these cases continue to slog through the courts for decades, not always compensating the right people. So let's look at the Japanese system. So the first thing to say is that there's no sovereign immunity, as I mentioned before. And the more I've thought about this, the more I'm convinced that this is a hugely important distinction between the two systems. Okay, and what I've also seen is that the courts are more than willing, at the drop of a hat, to hold the state, right, the Japanese government, and local prefectures accountable. They have no hesitation in doing that. Okay? So this, you know, you can see what kind of pressure this would put on the government, right, to regulate. If the government knows on the back end, right, it's going to have to compensate. And by the way, this is not good for people in power, right? They get, you know, sort of thrown out of office when this happens, right? So it does create some pressure. Now, you might not have the same people always, right, involved, but it does create some kind of pressure to regulate beforehand. So even though, as I said before, the whole theory of having government compensation is open to challenge, it does have the effect of putting pressure on government to do more effective regulating up front, better to avoid harm, along with liability and the attendant negative publicity. So how it works in Japan, we have a complex mix of regulation, and the regulation of nuclear power plants was much in the news even here after the Fukushima disaster. And we have tort, and their tort law, this is greatly oversimplified, bears a pretty good resemblance to our tort law system. They don't have civil juries, it's true, but in terms of the standards of liability, they don't have class actions, but they have mechanisms that approximate class actions. They have a civil law system, which is based on the German system, so it comes from statute, but they've created basically tort law doctrine that looks a lot like our tort law, which was surprising to me. But they have a bunch of compensation systems, okay? And my thinking is that you're going to get more compensation systems when you have a situation where the government's going to have to end up either regulating or paying, right? So if they have to pay anyway, because there's no sovereign immunity, they're going to be more likely, I think, to create these compensation systems. So you've got compensation systems for vaccine injuries, which we do have here. It's one of our rare successes in forming a compensation system. They do have asbestos compensation. They have a fund for victims of air pollution. There's like 1 million people in Tokyo have asthma, so they have compensation for that. And then there's this compensation system that I read about in detail that time won't let me sort of go into in any great length. And it was for victims of mercury poisoning. There was a corporation that was putting mercury and heavy metals like cadmium into the water, and all these people were becoming sick. And if you read the account of it, it really is a fascinating and a complex interplay between tort, okay, because the victims were suing in tort. This then got a compensation system to be formed, all right? The compensation system, after a while, there was pressure from industry, right, to to make it more restrictive in terms of who qualify for compensation. There's something called, I've never heard of this before, the Hunter-Russell syndrome, and some of the symptoms are ataxia, a constriction of the visual field, and speech impediments. And so at first they said if you had any one of these, you were considered to have Hunter-Russell when you were in. And then the industry put pressure on the government. They said, no, you have to have all three of them. So then people were out, and then people sued, right? And so it's a constant back and forth. Eventually, the Japanese Supreme Court, because it has jurisdiction over these cases in Japan, said that both the government, the federal government, well, the state government, and the prefecture were liable for not regulating sufficiently to prevent this from happening. Okay? And this did a number of things. It got the company to cough up all this money. Okay? And it also changed the status of the people who were victims from these sort of pariahs, because they were seen as interfering with the economic livelihood of the right of the area. Since the mercury poisoning took place back as far as the 50s, no one really understood what was going on. People thought they had a contagious disease, so they were considered marked or stigmatized for that reason. The Supreme Court's decision really changed the way these people were looked at. So I think you really have in this case sort of a more comprehensive approach. And if you look at Fukushima and BP, again, we see compensation systems. In both cases, we see economic losses will be compensated paramount. Although in Fukushima, there's going to be sort of the next phase of compensation, and there's going to be compensation for property damage. They're not doing that right now. Difficult issues of line drawing are endemic to compensation systems. Right, you really want to be in the system, right? So in the U.S., for example, it's with the vaccine injury compensation, there are certain injuries that are on a table of things that are considered to be caused by the particular vaccines, okay? If your injury is on that table, it's presumptively caused by the vaccine. If it's not, it's presumptively not caused by the vaccine, okay? So there's a lot that goes into sort of what's on the table. There's a lot that goes into who qualifies for compensation, and that never changes. It's sort of a lot of where the fun is, okay? And then one of the things that I think is really obvious is, you know, BP is about oil, which people want and need, right? Fukushima, nuclear power, hugely important source of energy in Japan. And for a while after Fukushima, saying, that's it, we're done with nuclear power. And now they're already saying, no, we're not so much done with nuclear power because it's a major source of what we need. So my sort of take on this is when we need the energy, we capture the agencies, right? Because it's easier for industry to capture agencies, which is another way to say to sort of under-regulate them when it's seen as sort of a national priority. The hedge against that is, of course, the presence of sovereign immunity or the lack of it, I think, really plays an important piece. Let's look at some of the differences. Fukushima is receiving a massive infusion of government. I shouldn't say Fukushima, I should say TEPCO, okay, which is the Tokyo Electric Power Company, is receiving a massive infusion of government money, which it must pay back over time. Okay, and the idea is without that money, they couldn't pay anybody. All right, and the government is floating bonds in order to get that to happen. In this case, we have long-term personal injury concerns, which we don't have with the BP oil spill. And one of the things I think is important is, I don't know if it's just a cultural difference between Japan and here, is that there's been a clear and unequivocal apology that happened very quickly from TEPCO, which I think, you know, those that sort of look at medical malpractice issues know about the importance of apology, and I think it might apply here as well. So I would say what I would regard as a healthy relationship is this kind of endless feedback loop between tort liability, a creation of administrative compensation systems, and regulation. Because the regulation, even if you have good regulation, you're not going to capture all of the cases, right? There are going to be some injuries that take place. And therefore, depending on the kind of harm you have, If it's a large-scale harm, it's going to be much more effective and efficient to do it as administrative compensation. But the tort liability system in Japan has been a really effective mechanism of getting the administrative compensation systems to be better. Because you never have to go the administrative compensation route in Japan. You always have your tort option. So if the administrative compensation isn't generous enough or it's too restrictive, people go into tort, and that ends up being a lot worse for government. They end up having to pay more. It's embarrassing. All these facts come out. They'd rather not see. So that's a healthy relationship. This is not healthy. Okay, well, industry is the big cog driving everything, and it pushes the regulation. I mean, PowerPoint only gives you so many options. So the arrow should be going up from regs to injury, okay? But that's an unhealthy relationship, and that's what some would argue we have here in the U.S., at least to a certain extent. Okay, so how can we improve population outcomes? And then I'm done. So I really think, like, the more I thought about this, the more I see, and I realize that there's no silver bullet here, but sovereign immunity, I think, is a big part of the problem. We see it in Katrina, where people don't have a lot of options, and it really hasn't gotten the government to sort of act in a way that I think would be responsible. It might ameliorate the problem of the agency capture of agencies. I'm sorry, industry capture of agencies. Another crazy idea, I think I'm the first one to think of this, is to consider alternative safer energies and technologies. Look, there's a limit to how safe nuclear energy can be, you know? And sort of over the span of, you know, all nuclear power plants, right, Fukushima wasn't so bad. It's nothing like Chernobyl, which was basically like, you know, please, you know, sort of like begging for a meltdown. It wasn't like that at all. It took a 9.0 earthquake and a tsunami, right? So there's a limit to how safe these things can be. And then I would say compensate when necessary, but keep in mind these broader distributional concerns that I think always have to be considered when you're compensating some people in the larger society, and it really is taxpayer money that's doing it. So I'll stop there and see if anybody has any questions. Yeah.
Clarification, one question. Did you say that in New York, $8.6 million per year was the compensation?
Total. For one person.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My other question related to this is, isn't compensation somewhat based on future earnings plus maybe pain and suffering? Is there something like this?
In tort law, it is, and in tort law, it's unbounded. Okay, so there's no limit in tort. Compensation systems usually have some kind of built-in limits. For example, with the vaccine compensation, there is a limit for pain and suffering because those are the it's called general damages, as opposed to special damages like medical, which you can sort of show. But there's a limitation because otherwise, you know, in order for industry, right, to agree that a compensation system is in their best interest and to get the buy-in that you need to get legislation passed, they have to be convinced that even though more people will be compensated, it's the accounting will be clearer, that they have a better sense of what they're ultimately going to be liable for. Does that make sense? Anybody else? Yes, thank you.
So this concept of eliminating sovereign immunity is quite provocative. Are there parameters to your elimination of sovereign immunity or outright?
I would just use tort principles. I mean, I think there's strict liability in cases where there's abnormally dangerous activity, which a lot of this is. Mm-hmm. But I think mostly it's negligence. And because of my concern about, you know, overall distributions, I might put some kind of a cap on what you can get from government. I'm not sure what that would be. And I also think, in a way...
For non-economic laws.
Yeah,
right?
Oh, absolutely. But I also think that if you got rid of sovereign immunity, you would find a lot more compensation systems being put into place, and therefore the tort system wouldn't feel the strain. One other thing I might mention about Katrina is that, you know... There's a lot of smart plaintiff's attorneys out there, right? So there's the flood management, right, sort of issue, and there was a statute passed by Congress in, I think, 1927 that immunizes government for negligence in connection with flood control programs. And it was in response to some flooding in the Mississippi River back then. but it doesn't deal with other kinds of commercial sort of moving of water. So there's something called the Mr. Go. You know what the Mr. Go is? The Mississippi River Gulf Outlet, which was created as a way of shunting the Mississippi right away from the city and sort of creating a separate path down to the Gulf. And what that did was destroy a lot of the wetlands that really are a natural buffer that keep hurricane surges from being as devastating. And so one of the arguments is that the construction of Mr. Go, which no one thinks was a flood control project, right, is something for which the government could be liable. And those claims have been able to survive at least the dismissal stage. So there are ways sometimes of getting around sovereign immunity.